No, but in the shell.
Sandy Fish is real Saudi man. Then some people say, I don't know why those people want to go to church so much. It's so boring. It's so trying and tiring. Well, why don't you change churches? There's nothing boring around here. This is interesting. It's the most interesting work in the world. Satan, there is a name that has power. There is a name that's above every other name. And you know that name, and you know what it is. This woman is going to preach again. God's going to save her and fill her with the Holy Ghost tonight. Put a new call of God on her life. Because the callings and the gifts of God are without repentance. If God ever called a man or woman to preach, the calling is still there. It's not that it's being used, but the call is still there. In the name of Jesus, I command you to say, I am going.
To protect it, and my time.
all want to know that.
Save the soul, Heavenly Father, let me ask you this morning, how bless you on the world that morning, how lost in the mud and down the river, how it is down in the
well, back to the virgin side. To my pain, I run the pain. To my pain, with joy outstrip the wind.
Well, the women, they came along, Lord,
Hiroshima, and that was very peculiar. I didn't know what that was, but it was so strong and so bright. And after about 15 or 20 seconds, we heard a big noise of concussions blowing over our boat. And that was so strong, our boat was leaned about 15 or maybe 20 degrees to the left.
I was there in this building, the Oval, and the only thing I remember clearly was the lightning, the fire like a lightning, and then I remember nothing, still I was standing in the garden outside of the house.
I was standing in front of the house and saw a strange flash of light which ran through the midair from east to the west. I felt danger. So I took a couple of steps into a garden there and lay down on the ground between two rocks. Then I felt a strong blast of wind. Many splinters of board and roof tile fell upon me. I thought I was hit. When I got up, I found the house behind me had been destroyed and saw a few people coming out of debris here and there.
I'm thinking a bomb hit on my house and I was there to die. But I did not die because I found somebody buried in the same place where I was. Mr. Maehara, our next door neighbor, who was standing in his garden about 50 yards away, was blown off from his place and buried in the same place where I was.
Cooperation through understanding, through trying to have a place where all of the people who come from different countries with different ideas can get together and lay their pieces of truth on the table and try to find out where these pieces fit into the whole picture, and gradually make Hiroshima a more internationally minded center and also a more concerned place where people try to help each other.
Hate American people, I think. In fact, I like America, I respect America and American people, but many people, I think, understand the tragedy we had in Hiroshima happened because it was the wartime. And all the people in Hiroshima hate war and not any one country or any...
But in America, we have the pose of risk, the stance of risk, the beatnik. Seem to be defiant, they seem to be daring, but they are cautiously daring. But they really are the lapdogs of a bourgeoisie so well fed that after the meal it can afford to let the court jest to kid them a little bit. And in America, what is daring immediately later becomes the cover of Time magazine or Life, and instead of being daring comes one more stereotype. So I think in Russia they really stick their neck out to protest against communist materialism. The so-called rebel poets of San Francisco and so on are very cautious rebels, and they belong more to the issue of publicity than the issue of liberty. What would you say that in connection with the beast poets?
I would agree with that entirely.
You don't think they're so daring, really?
Oh, no.
Cautious daring.
I'm with two fine poets who are men. I'm in another position. I'm in the middle of another fight that's been going on in the New York Times, saying that I am impossible, that I cannot exist, that there are no women poets. Now, we have this other thing, hoping for the men who will speak for the things that are needed, too, hoping as poets, hoping as women. And we seem to take the risk that everybody says women do not take. Now, they use women as an image for something here, where people use...
You older mother.
Whatever it comes through as.
Like,
but it's the unborn thing.
We've also had poets on camera three. I don't think we've had three at one time, and I think the subject is really poetry reading.
I'd like to invite each one of you to give us just one brief touch of a poetry reading for camera three right now. Could we start with you, Mr. Dickey?
Yeah. One of the great mirror Rickheiser, it's not a question if he's a good woman poet or a good man, but he's a good poet, period, that's all.
He's good. That's a point that's very important.
He's good.
I'm glad you made it.
You want me to read something, did you?
Yes.
Start
it off.
All right. This is just a poem about a man and a woman in a swimming pool at night near an apartment house where everybody else is asleep and the water is heated. And they're the only ones there in the pool, and the air is cold as it will be when you get out of a heated swimming pool at night. It's called the night pool. There is this other element that shines at night near human dwellings, glows like wool from the sides of itself far down. From the deep end of heated water, I am moving toward her, first swimming, then touching my light feet to the floor, rising like steam from the surface to take her in my arms, beneath the one window still giving off unsleeping light. There is this other element, it being late enough, and in it I lift her and can carry her over any threshold in the world, into any of these houses, apartments, her shoulders streaming, or above them into the mythical palaces. Her body lies in my arms like a child, not drowned, not drowned. And I float with her off my feet. We are here. We move differently, sustained, closer together, not weighing on ourselves or on each other, not mere fish or anything but light. The one human light from above that we lie in, breathing its precious abandoned gold. We rise out into our frozen land body, and her lips turn blue, sealed against me. What I can do in the unforgivable cold, in the least sustaining of all brute worlds, is to say nothing, not ask forgiveness, but only give her all that in my condition I own, wrap her in many towels.
Thank you, James Dickey. May I look as a man, thank you.
Thank you. This is the last of a group of poems that will be published soon called The Outer Banks. These are the Outer Banks, the actual ones, off North Carolina, the landscape of the Raleigh Expedition, a Huck Crane poem of the Wright brothers, and the Outer Banks of experience, the edge of experience that comes through again in another way. The quotation is from Selma early this year. Part 12 of The Outer Banks. The wreck of the tiger, the early pirate, the blood crimes arc, the tyrant's acute eye, all buried mathematical instruments, cast away skeletons, drowned five strand pearl necklaces, hopes of livelihood, hopes of grace, walls of houses, sepia, sea fences, the writhing octopus, and those tall masts and sails, marked hulls of ships, and last month's plane, dipping his salute to the stone wing of dreams, turbulence, arm and soul, the dark, young, living people. Sing one more song, and you are under arrest. Sing another song. Women, ships, lost voices, whatever has dissolved into our waves, I, a lost voice, moving, calling you on the edge of the moment that is now the center from the open sea.
Thank you, Mr. Tiger. Mr. Ray?
The poem is called To Be Strong. It's from a book called The First Morning, published by Scribner, that was read last at the Wagner College Writers Conference. It has five stanzas which get ever more sentimental and cloying to the point of being unbearable, and then bang, like a slap in the face, it turns out to be a cruel practical joke on the reader, because it seems to be a sentimental song about the world's birthday, as a song about the dying in the ditches of the world, but in the last fifth stanza, it turns out, the Arcadian, yes, and Idle, yes, but an Arcadian Idle for always 1984, but Auschwitz.
spells and cartoons, how even in that world there can be two things, courage and love. Blossom should blossom one petal of apple. Two more the blooms are as leaves are to flower. It would be to the others as you are my daughter, to all of the daughters whose songs are adored. But what am I here for if not to make love songs of all the world's beauty whose birthday we share? Purest of fragrances, brood of concussions, too delicate, lonely to ever be shared. It would be to the others as you are my daughter, to all other daughters whose forms are uncertain. What am I here for if not to weave lassos of thorn for the lonely discouragement of love? Say yes to the breezes, if any disheveled one curl of a ringlet, I'll know and be with you. The great nose that stays on the wind beats of normal are led till they feel it. They're singing your cry. What if the thorn falls not the smooth ringlet, the sword is too hurt by the throes of the world? When storms replace breezes, no hurt can have healing. Then the love I now sing you can pillow your face. But what am I here for if not to link fingers with daughters whose wistfulness world never ends? But what is a storm for if not to stretch hands out to signal the warning you're never alone? Dig graves now, we're coming to seek you. I'll help with your sorrow. I'll know and be with you. Give you a second to look up from digging, to look at the sun while I feel the sand. What is love here for if not to sleep ditches for all the world's daughters whose dying we share?
Thank you, Peter.
Poem means hope and direct speech. It seems to me that that wish for direct speech has a lot to do with that small, honest core, which is about listening to poetry. We're all listeners to poetry, as well as writers. One looks for the same thing in hearing it, in a way of understanding one's own feelings. Mr. Dickey said, a way of speaking directly as one moves to another person's experience, or of diving deeply enough into one's own experience, so one gets to a sound tape which is not what they call obscure, meaning shallow, and which can be shared.
And you put the spur to the young American college student a little while ago, Mr. Garrett. You had a chance to see quite a number of them. Don't you feel that there are some who are genuinely concerned?
The minority is always the thing, whether poetry happens to be unfashionable or one generation or hugged to death for next. But I think what you're trying to do after three poems that attempt tragic beauty, or however unsuccessfully, is to end with a positive note. You're a positive thinking, great humanist gentleman. Well, I don't want you. I don't want to end with a positive note. I don't want any chirping Pollyanna ending. The bland leading the bland. Life is a mess. The world is not governed by reason nor by justice, and the only justification that can be for the mess is the aesthetic justification of tragedy. And I won't have anything to do with Pollyanna wants to crack. I'll leave it out of the positive.
I think the record, as the camera sees you and knows, this program.
The soul seller, Rose Salavi, or Marcel Duchamp. They are all the same man, Marcel Duchamp. If I were an art dictionary, but I'm not, I might tell you now that Marcel Duchamp is born July 27 or 28, doesn't matter very much, 1887 in Normandy. It doesn't seem to interest you very much. Fine. But you are telling me just now that the quotation which you read just now during the German play intrigues you very much. It's rather fascinating. There is no problem because there is no solution. There is no solution because there is no problem. But that's a quite different story and a rather long one.
Freedom in a good sense that I never heard of in Europe. you are free, and in other words, people let you do what you want, unless you go against them, and then you will have to avoid the car and automobile here, because then you need to have an automobile, you have to leave it on one side of the street, not the other side, like in France, of course, but much more strict here. It might be, as you said, a Protestant region, the region isn't a religion of the country. That means there's a difference between the Catholic and the religion in the Protestant in this case. Well, the Catholic would go after
you.
Well, to know everything you do and spy on you and all kinds of things. You don't. Even a little further, when you are invited somewhere, when you have a hard time finding an excuse for not going, if you don't want to go, here you just say, I don't feel like coming tonight or something. They're absolutely correct. So you don't have a automobile, you don't have a wife, you don't have a children, and you don't have a house in the country. All these great expenses bring you more trouble than even money will cost. It's an imposition. Really not worth the while, and if you can avoid it. And if it's had it, you can't say I don't want one.
So it means that you are just 5 years old.
Yes, and I should have done.
Was it difficult to get this one-man show?
No, it was not difficult because I didn't look for it.
Came to you?
It came to me in New York about a year ago and started picking up things here and there after the show. With such patience, such knowledge, it's really remarkable. The man is wonderful. It's such a long, big time. You see, from 1902 to 1963 or 61 or whatever it is. With one example almost of every year, you know, it's really very comforting for me. I mean, or it's very pleasing, I think. I was near the Hollywood Boulevard.
Few he painted in all his years, it seems clear that it will hardly ever be easy to understand Marcel Duchamp. He now seemed to us exactly like some great battle plan of life and intellect, a battle plan which had long since prepared its defense tactics. Perhaps he had, in fact, already ventured into a world of ideas so far from ours that we might never catch up. Then we remembered what we had been told by others. Jean Reynolds.
Well, I would put it this way, that the remarkable thing I think about him is that when he finished his work, rather than repeat it, removed himself from the world of art and watched himself as though he were not here, say, and his work was living, and he saw what happened to it over those periods of time. And he's very helpful, the young artist. He liked him, and they loved him.
George Semple.
They are terribly impressed by his personality. I think that his influence on the youngest artist is not so much a result of his actual body of painting, of work, so they obviously have studied it and they know about it. But what really is important to them is to feel the spirit of youth in him, to have him interested in them, to be of their age, of their group practically, is what really has such a wonderful force and draws them to him.
Nicholas Kalla.
He's extremely important because all the young artists, I'm talking of the ones who have, whose creative capacities, of course, I consider are very interesting, pay enormous attention to what Duchamp might be saying, and because they consider that he expresses better, probably, than any other artist of an older generation, problems which preoccupies them today. I will never forget the time I went with Marcel Duchamp, went then for the first time to see artists who were then quite unknown, was Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. And I was sure with what interest and at the same time what excitement they were waiting to see what Duchamp would say.
Philippe Johnson. For me, Marcel Duchamp was the earliest influence in my life of any of the artists of the 20th century. He was the man first to capture my imagination, not only all artists, but the ones that are still alive. He came closest to having an influence on my eyes. But by training your eyes to look differently, he recreated all the arts of the 20th century.
Now, for instance, I would say that when Duchamp doesn't paint, he is as important as when he's painting, because his personality is what counts and everybody knows that. And I'm convinced, or at least I like saying to myself, that some very famous artists of today who have other working habits and who believe in painting all the time, each time they paint a new picture, they might say, ah, there is Marcel Duchamp that has not done another painting.
But Marcel Duchamp's approach to life, I find the most admirable that I know of. I mean, without being just the pinkest as a Sartre or a Camus, he involves the whole attitude of our century toward reality. That is, why do you play chess, Monsieur Duchamp? Why should I not play chess? I mean, if you think life is so important, that chess all of a sudden is not important.
Hans Richter.
He is a phenomenon. He is regarded the most thirsty nihilist. He doesn't believe in anything. He certainly doesn't believe in art. He gave it the 1930 already, the so-called ready-made, which were an anti-art declaration at the time of Dada. 1915, 16, 17, 18, he created some more of these things. And he was therefore elected by the new generation, the pop art artist, as a kind of a saint.
Naum Gabo.
His philosophy and art is the difference from my philosophy on art. But because the philosophy was for him not just a few words or a thing to think about only, but it was a guide for his life. And he acted according to this philosophy.
Without any compromise.
Without any compromise. And that is what is very rare in our world of artists. But he really believed in that the art, painting and sculpture and this kind of thing, they are not such of such importance. And he was very often saying that it's the same thing to me as playing chess. And in particularly, because he stopped to paint, the moment he felt that he has nothing more to say.
Bill Copley. For me, Marcel is the only person I know who is totally a myth. The best example of it, I think, is everybody's always commenting on the fact that he stopped painting so many years ago. But he hasn't. He was able to carry it further into his entirely, carry it into life itself, so that it was no longer necessary for him to be an artist on canvas with his hands. He became an artist in the way he lived. And I don't know anybody else who's really accomplished that.
I was rather sorry, to tell you the truth, in the 20s, because I knew his paintings, and I considered him one of the very, very, very few, very few indeed, when I say few, that I don't think I can name three. A man who had the classical spirit. We also remember Dussault entering the home of his old friend, the French-American composer Edgar Varèse, in Greenwich Village.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine.
That's
fine.
How are you?
Fine. Yeah,
good.
Great
to
see
you. I'm back from California, from Pasadena, twice in a month,
and pretty good there.
Well, I had a show, a big show.
Yes, this I know. How did it go?
Well, fine, wonderful, wonderful place. And they, you see, they filmed it all together for the
They were there with you?
We 4 days of it, 4 days, 7 hours a day.
So you are three now, huh? You know what they want to do?
Regular movie actor.
And you're going to stay now?
I'm going to stay all winter. Yeah.
Oh, good.
What about you?
So you don't go back to Spain immediately, no?
Spain, no. Spain is cold now. The Pyrenees are not too warm. And what about you?
I've been just working as usual and for everything.
Same old thing?
Same old thing.
You go to...
Mr. Dussault, while you're speaking already of the same subject during the First World War when you met?
No, we didn't change the subject at all. But we were babies then, so to speak, and trying to get away from the war as we very well did. It was fun. That was very amusing.
Yeah, very nice and very good.
But no speak French TV, do you remember?
No.
You had to learn English.
Yeah.
No question.
Oh, yeah. No,
and I forgot.
In New York, it's been great. Your downtown, everything is demolished, you know, everything is going down, big building coming up.
So, I mean, it's not the same place.
No.
And the people have changed.
Digital cafes are no good, but they're changed.
And all the cafes are espresso.
Yeah, they're espresso, Italian. And
it's our village, huh?
I'm thinking, it seems to me that you are brothers at all, no?
Yeah,
I think so.
Absolutely. Yeah. We just need the same mother, that's all. We all have it.
The father of what is it so right? We don't know.
We don't care.
No, Marcel Duchamp, your one-man show is over. You are the last visitor. What are you feeling now?
Well, I feel like 1902 and 1902 when I made this painting. It's already a form of impressionism I was interested in at that time. I was influenced by Manet, but as you see, it's very far from being a real impressionism. And it always was done in the vacation time when I came to see my family there. I was very young then. It was my first step toward painting, if I may say.
Normandy.
In Normandy, where I was born. I was born in this house.
The home of a CPA, still inhabited today by a CPA.
We're going to go up on the body.
You heard of him before?
Yes.
His father was a notary before mine and lived in this house until 1904.
I was baptizing that church.
I received Marcel Duchamp here and his brothers and sisters, Jacques Villon in particular, a friend of my family. After the reception, he asked us quite simply to let them walk in the garden, and particularly towards two big trees at the bottom of the park, where they had long ago written their names, carved their names, where you can still see the name Duchamp and the date 1901.
And what is your age at that time?
15, 15.
Who is this woman?
This woman is my brother's
wife,
the sculptor, Duchamp, Raymond Duchamp Villon. And she's still alive.
In this painting, there is a kind of expressionism.
Yeah, you mean, yes, it's a combination of expressionism and fauvism. In other words, you know, after all, the German expressionism at that time was influenced also by Matisse, in fact. And I was also influenced by Matisse.
This painting is almost the same.
Yes, it's the same epoch. It's 1910, 1910, both of them. And it is also in Rouen, with a group of artists in Rouen.
In that time, you are trying to become a painter.
Yes.
Marcel Duchamp is not born.
I'm just a mere painter. I'm not yet, and I have absolutely no idea of becoming any Marcel Duchamp at all.
Mm. We still are in 1910.
Yes, 1910. Probably Easter time, because 1910 was a very, very busy year for me, and now I don't remember really the month in which I made those paintings. But as you know, it's with my father, and my father, I must say, was a great man in that sense that he decided to help his sons, artists,
three artists,
three of them, up to as long as he could, which was a great idea.
And what was the system?
The system was very simple. We would ask him for money, he would give it to us, almost without questioning, but mark it on a piece of paper. And the addition at the end would be deducted after it for each one. Since we had three sisters, so when he died, we never got a penny, Dino and I, and the three sisters got their inheritance, which was a very good and very easy, because Dino really was well helped until, I don't know, age 50 or age 60. Incredible for our father to do that, and he will remember that very long. And you see how different from the things we saw before? How Cezanne is very
similar to Cezanne in turn.
Completely. And as because there's a difference of only a few months between Cole, who we saw, and the young. I don't understand how I could have changed so much as the difference, and especially at this
point. Very few months, after all.
Quite 3 or 4 months, you see. I must have seen something of Suzanne in 19, well, I don't know.
All ideas of realistic or pseudo-realistic painting, and try to invent something like this painting, which is a repetition of the same mood 5 times, and it was my interpretation of cubism, you see, as I understood it at the time. I was really, theoretically speaking, I was not very much interested in explaining to myself what cubism was or should be. I wanted to invent one, and this was the first step toward it. After this one, came like the king and the queen, surrounded by Christians. Yes, my king and my queen are not monarchistic, but they are a test-like and have just the right skills. And the nudes are not existing anatomically, but they exist as expressing the movement of nudes. In the king and the queen, there was the idea of the title, very important to me, to insist that the title should be part of the painting. The title was as important. It was, and just going against the grain of everything at that time, you shouldn't have a title to any painting, otherwise you would be called a literary painter. It was anathema.
United.
Of course, that was my idea, to reintroduce the idea of titles in it, and of course, a very poetic one.
And here we are in front of the famous nude.
Yes. Famous is right, but as I told you, there's absolutely a mystery. There is a mystery there, because you paint paintings one after another, and why should one be so different than the other? It could be a mystery and a scandal, a successive scandal. There's absolutely no sense of reason, and I never was able to understand, and I was the first one to be surprised at success. It is a good expression, again, well, my theories of the time, or at least my intentions of the time, which was to express movement in a different way from the futurist, a little, at least, keeping the color, the coloring of the cubist, not indulging in the crude color of the cypress. I was very partial to the colors of the cubist, because in my reasoning, it was much more important to make your colors than to take them out of the tube. In other words, there is much more. My paint, you know, my paint, if you want to say, painting the colors I made myself, then using a tube, and out of the tube would come a red, a beautiful vermilion, and on from the canvas it goes, which is all right, but it was not my idea. In this one, it is a different story, because Arnsberg, whom I saw in 1915 when I first came here, wanted to have the nude stars, the passage from the Virgin to the Bride, because there is another.
Always a wonderful,
a drawing,
title.
A drawing
called the Virgin, and there is a painting called the Bride, and there is a painting called the Passage from one to the other. Of course, there is a play on words there, in a way, because you can say it might be illogical or erotic or whatever you want to call it. But the main point was to have a double meaning, which is interesting at the time.
And when you see all these paintings again, Marcel Duchamp, what do you think now?
Well, again, it's a great pleasure because it's another form of another point of my life when I had so many decisions to make. And it's a pleasant feeling to be able to see why I did it at the time and how I did it. And the result was satisfactory, and that's the main thing. There was a decision to abandon what I knew, what I had been influenced by, mainly.
And your Cubist friends.
My Cubist friends, all this. And even that is difficult because there was a friendship. Not a normal friendship to these people, and I had to cut completely, not relations. But I mean, there was no exchange anymore. There was exchange before, long. Enormous at the time of 1910 of the Blair and McCarthy, even when they wrote their book, we had special seances where we discussed things and so forth. So at that time, in 1912, it was a decision, a very important decision to actually abandon Cubism and go somewhere else.
For being alone
and not knowing where I was going. If I had known, it had to be started and brought out from the my inside me, which I don't know whether I had it at all. It might have been just a complete not existing at all. Anyway, that was the ambition I had, and I was glad I had it. Yes, a sort of a prize fighter, one round after another. I've been through many rounds, you know, but my prize fights were more than 15 rounds, like as usual today.
But probably the most important is the individual.
Yes, that was the real reason for my problem. The problem with the individual, I mean, school is very interesting as such, but not as interesting as an individual. But even not only the artist, but the artist especially should be alone. I mean, there's no question. Art or anti-art? This was the dilemma in which I found myself in 1912 when I came back from my trip to Munich. I then was determined to find a way of expressing myself, which are the two facets of the same thing. The only form you could use is an art, as much closer to what I mean by completely forgetting about the idea of aesthetic in the old sense, and form a form of expression which couldn't be aesthetic in the sense of visual, retinal impression of a painting by introducing those elements of humor and long titles and even eroticism, things that really did exist before but not mixed up with painting. Italia came at the same time. Glaze also had come, and
Cubist painter,
and Corti, my brother-in-law, who also painted in a Cubist manner, and Barret, the composer. All these five or six people were completely together and hardly speaking any English. So we were very close to one another, and we had all kinds of advantages, and learning English and learning English.